Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll follow along with a school principal going door to door to track down students who've fallen behind during remote learning. Schools are doing more to add diversity programs into the curriculum, but not everyone has been pleased with that change.
It was the first time I've ever received so much hate mail and an article, several articles that, you know, were aimed to discredit me and threats.
A new healthcare law in Illinois aims to promote equity. We'll learn more about what it will do. The pandemic didn't stop a college rowing team from getting out on the water. And an Illinois community has a program to get rid of empty and decaying buildings. It's an effort to spur new growth. We'll hear all of those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll take a look at the state's teacher shortage and what the future might hold for that. Also, remote learning. That's been a problem for many students. Some have fallen way behind. We'll follow along a principal going door to door to find them and get them back on track. And the pandemic didn't stop a college rowing team. Those stories and more ahead this hour. More schools are adding diversity programs into teacher training and curriculum as the country grapples with systemic racism. It's also brought some backlash from people who think the work is divisive. School officials say some discomfort is expected, but a more vocal resistance is on the rise. Susie Ahn shares what's happening in one suburban Chicago area district.
Back in February, Dina Simmons was the keynote speaker for an equity and inclusion session hosted by the Naperville School District.
I spoke about the importance of self-care and community care.
An anonymous teacher took issue with the program, which also covered anti-racist teaching and experiences of marginalized groups. The teacher took some of Simmons' materials to The Federalist, a conservative online magazine. Simmons said an article misrepresented her and the work of the district.
It was the first time I've ever received so much hate mail. And an article, several articles that, you know, were aimed to discredit me and threats.
She says some of the messages read, quote, go back to Africa, or that she was racist. Simmons says this reflects what's happening nationally. Over the past few years, more schools have incorporated diversity, equity, and inclusion programs into their missions, and it accelerated after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The rise in DEI programs was followed by a major backlash in some places, including at the federal level.
When former President Trump was in office, he was trying to, you know, put in an executive order where we should put an end to diversity training because it separates people.
She says that rhetoric against anti-racism work continues. In Oklahoma, the State House recently approved a bill that would ban teaching critical race theory in schools. The Biden administration proposed a grant program for teaching U.S. history that prioritizes efforts that reflect the diversity of all students. A number of House Republicans criticized it, saying it's divisive. Naperville School District administrators also received harassing messages following the February seminar, including an email that said the superintendent was, quote, lying subhuman scum who needed to be protested while out with his family. Another said the district should get rid of, quote, all the black bigots. Superintendent Dan Bridges says he's taken aback by these hateful messages, especially since the district is in its third year of equity work.
We've heard from a couple individuals from time to time questioning and wondering really the relevance or the purpose of our work. Dr. Leakes and I have both met with some individuals. Again, this work is, you know, ongoing for us. We've not had the type of reaction that we've had recently.
The district hired Dr. Rakita Leakes as head of diversity and inclusion a few years ago. Leakes asks staff to be open to learning something that might feel uncomfortable, but to feel safe asking questions.
Even something like white privilege, in no way is this about shame and blame. None of the work that we're doing is about shame and blame. It is about being critically self-reflective.
The school district isn't following a trend. They say its DEI initiative is out of necessity. For example, a white high school student posted a Craigslist ad trying to sell a black student a couple of years ago. Superintendent Bridges says it's sad that the equity efforts are viewed as divisive when it's really about the success of students. He says it's about the district trying to eliminate systemic inequities.
We're a very high-achieving school district. But when you peel that onion back a little bit and take a much closer look, you see that there's some pretty significant opportunity and achievement gaps. You look at some of the other data in our school district, we have disproportionate suspension rates.
Bridges says overwhelmingly there is support from the school board and staff for this work. It's been a small number who disagree, and a lot of the hateful messages appear to be coming from outside of the community. Dina Simmons says what's happening now can't just be reduced to partisanship. This resistance has always existed at some level, but she says there's hope. The people who attacked her didn't take the time to consider her as a person. It may sound Pollyanna-ish, but she thinks the simple act of spending time with a person should be the baseline.
I'm not saying that we have to agree. I'm saying that we at least need to acknowledge, respect, and recognize another's humanity.
Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
Illinois has fewer unfilled job openings in its school districts than it did last year. That's according to the Illinois State Board of Education. But Christine Hatfield reports experts say they don't expect the current solutions to the state's teacher shortage will last much longer.
Districts across the state reported more than 4,800 job openings as of last school year. Data from this fall shows that number dropped a few hundred. Mark Kleisner is the president of the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools. He says remote learning during the COVID-19 pandemic gives teachers flexibility they normally do not have. That's kept some of them from leaving the profession.
In some respects, while you're in a remote environment, that solves some of the problems. You can actually, as a teacher, you could serve more students in a remote environment.
That means some teachers pick up more classes, which helps districts disguise the shortage of qualified teachers. Kleisner says he doesn't expect loading up teachers with extra class sections to be a permanent solution to the teacher shortage, especially as Illinois heads for phase 5 of reopening.
I don't believe that the pool of qualified people grew. I think we're going to see exactly the opposite in the summer of 21.
Kleisner says he expects the pandemic will make the shortage worse next school year.
Teachers are choosing to opt out and retire rather than come back into a perceived unsafe situation.
Even now, larger school districts feel the struggle. Take Bloomington's District 87. Suzanne Daniels is Director of Human Resources for the district. She says they've had to resort to short-term teacher approvals and 11th-hour hires to make things work.
There's just not as many educators out there, less people are going into teaching, and it's put a real burden and strain on the system.
District 87's Assistant Superintendent of Human Resources says politicians and media that vilify teachers aren't helping. Sherilyn Thomas says she'd like to see loan forgiveness and fixes to the state's teacher pension system.
There's just a lot of things that should be happening to just honestly make going into teaching more attractive.
Peoria Public School Superintendent Sharon Desmoulins-Carat says her district is trying many strategies to recruit teachers. That includes moving around staff and looking internationally for teacher prospects.
We're definitely plugging away, but it is... You have to be very intentional, very strategic, and it has to be monitored at least on a weekly basis, if not sooner, as it relates to staffing.
Above all, Karat says she wants to bring people already in the community into education.
We have to continue to grow our own and make it attractive because it is a very attractive profession. It's hard work, but it's such great, meaningful work.
Districts are trying to find other ways to bring more teachers into the profession. That often means working with teaching programs at state schools. The National Center for Urban Education at Illinois State University, for example, used to work with Peoria Public Schools on a pipeline program. It stopped when grant money ran out. Maria Zamudio is executive director of the center. She says Illinois State emphasizes community immersion and making sure teacher candidates have a chance to interact with community people and groups. Zamudio says she wants teachers to know their communities.
I think we're always trying to find ways to become more proactive. And thinking out of the box.
Kelly Apple is the Director of Enrollment and Transition Services in the College of Education at ISU. Apple says keeping educators in the profession isn't the only challenge for teaching programs. Keeping high school graduates in the state long enough to major in education is another. Apple says shortages in some subjects and geographic areas have been going for years.
We definitely need to try some different things because some of the avenues haven't fully been successful, clearly, or we wouldn't still have shortages.
School superintendents are also glum about the situation. 86% of respondents to a survey say they expect the shortage to remain a problem for at least 2 more years. I'm Christine Hatfield.
For 64 University of Illinois students on the Illini rowing team, mornings start before dawn and out on the water. Reporter Amanda Brennan spent a morning with the team at Clinton Lake in DeWitt County. And for these student athletes, it's been a full season, even during the COVID-19 pandemic.
On a Wednesday in early May, 11 cars pull up to the undergraduate library on the University of Illinois campus in the pitch black at 4:50 in the morning. For the crew members, this is just part of their daily routine. The team captains check Safer Illinois apps to make sure that everyone has had a recent negative COVID test.
All right, Danny, awesome. Whose car are you in?
Lucas,
awesome.
Then, the cars leave for what some describe as Narnia, that magical place with tall trees and mythical creatures. Clinton Lake is about 45 minutes west of campus in DeWitt County. It's a man-made cooling lake for a nearby power plant. The team has 9 miles of rowable water nearly year-round. Cheyenne Peterson and Vaughn Parker are team captains. Parker says he'd understand if going to a lake near a power plant may be unappealing.
Which sounds bad and dingy. I'm like, am I going to grow 11 toes by going to that lake? You know, but no. It's a really, really unique place. It's breathtaking. And you can see the sunrise over the water in the mornings. And it's just a beautiful experience.
Sophia Ebel is a member of the team.
It's very much a team sport where you are going out in boats and each person has one or two oars, depending on the kind of boat. But you almost always have multiple people in the same boat.
Getting up nice and tall. Yeah. Down the way. That's all. Good.
Michael Saravo is the head coach. He has only been with the team for a few months. He brings years of experience from overseas in the UK.
I say this to my athletes, I am an obsessive. Like, I love rowing and I just want to make their experience the best.
He wants to create a positive and collaborative environment for the team members.
And it's a we, not an I, though we're Illinois.
Because of COVID-19, athletes around the world have had their seasons canceled or postponed this year. At first, Illini Rowing was not sure if they would have a season either. They submitted a 5-page document to the university detailing the precautions they plan to take. Their season was then approved.
But here, there's a lot to take into account. So masks on in the cars always. No one sits in the middle seat, which reduces our capacity a lot.
In the boats, masks are now optional since over 50% of the team is fully vaccinated. Most of the boats are 60 feet long. That's the same length as a bowling lane. Even though the athletes sit far apart, their seats move forwards and backwards. They only take off masks if the people around them are comfortable with it.
Like, my boat specifically is like 100% vaccinated, so I feel very safe, like recently especially.
This year, the team is nearly undefeated. Coach Saravo and the team want this winning culture to continue.
Like, well, ultimately, I serve you as the athletes. So what do you want to do? And they said, well, we want to win and we want to perform. Okay, that's what we'll do then.
The team usually ends the school year competing in a national race. This year, they will compete in an informal version of the race at the end of May. Until then, they say they're just happy to be on the water. It's a bit of normalcy during a stressful year. I'm Amanda Brennan, Illinois Newsroom.
John Deere is being recognized for success of its farming education program in Nigeria. Last year, Deere partnered with a nonprofit and local farmers on the Rayuwa Project, which aims to teach Nigerian farmers better agricultural techniques. Now, Fast Company Business Magazine has named Deere a winner of its 2021 award for world-changing ideas. Mariana Bakiao has more.
Rayuwa means life or livelihood in the Hausa language. And according to data from its inaugural year, the Rayuwa Project is living up to its name. Nigeria experienced a 10% decrease in food scarcity during the summer of 2020, a time of the year known as hunger season. 3 months before harvest season, farmers in the region run low on food, and a lack of steady income depletes their savings. But despite a global pandemic and growing poverty in Nigeria, these farmers produced more and earned more, around $1.3 million more. Lekan Tobe is a member of Pixera Global who oversees the Rayua project. He says the program weathered the pandemic because he hired team members from the 11 target villages.
Most of the guys are actually in the village, some right in the community, some 10, 15 minutes from the village.
While the program started with 2,500 veteran farmers and 4,000 newcomers, Tobe says the total number of participating farmers in the region now tops 8,000. John Deere is mainly a sponsor for the project, although employees are encouraged to volunteer. Nate Clark, president of the John Deere Foundation, says Deere was one of 4,000 applicants for Fast Company's World Changing Ideas Awards.
We're still pinching ourselves about it. It's powerful confirmation that when people look at opportunities or activities that can change the world, that they realize that farmers play an important part in making the world a better place.
This year, the Rayua Project hopes to expand from 11 villages to 21. I'm Mariana Bacayao.
Well, as negotiations continue on how Illinois should overhaul its energy market, nuclear power giant Exelon is doubling down on its demands. Exelon operates 6 nuclear stations in the state and has threatened to shut down 2 of them unless state subsidies are approved. But now the company says 2 more plants could be closed if even more state funding isn't forthcoming. Governor J.B. Pritzker says Exelon needs a reality check.
They have a very widely divergent view than most people in the General Assembly do of what that energy package should look like. I think that Exelon must move closer to where the General Assembly is for us to end up with a solid energy package that does well by ratepayers.
Pritzker's office commissioned a study earlier this spring that found Exelon needed much less generous subsidies to keep its nuclear plants going. The company contends otherwise. There's still more to come on Statewide, turning protests into a learning experience. That's ahead. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois' pandemic-related moratorium on evictions will be phased out in August. Governor J.B. Pritzker made that announcement this week. But the state is launching a $1.5 billion housing assistance program funded by federal stimulus money to help ease the transition. Hannah Meisel has more on that.
Most of the grant money will go to renters, but $400 million of those dollars are planned for mortgage assistance in a separate program the state hasn't launched yet. State Representative Delia Ramirez of Chicago, who also pushed for the state's first wave of rental assistance last year, says this program is meant to avert a massive housing crisis.
So all people who right now are trying to figure out, do I pay for my rent or do I buy my diabetes medication? We are asking you, inviting you to apply for the assistance we have available.
Illinoisans are eligible for rental assistance if they're at least a month behind on rent and have experienced financial hardship due to the pandemic. They can access up to 15 months worth of rent for a maximum of $25,000. The money is paid directly to landlords. I'm Hannah Meisel.
Up next on Statewide, a history teacher has created a narrative video series about protests that took place in Rockford. Peter Medlin has that story.
Nicholas Stange's American history class is just starting a unit on the civil rights movement. But before they dive into history, they're supposed to examine similar current events so they can follow the thread back to help students fully grasp the topic at hand. Stange, a teacher at Harlem High School in McChesney Park, says that wasn't too difficult this year. During their discussions about calls for racial justice and the Black Lives Matter movement, he showed his students black and white photos he took at Rockford protests following George Floyd's murder.
We have seen some former students. When that happens, you feel like a sense of responsibility to make sure they're okay. Kind of becomes like a parenting thing at those moments.
Over 1,000 Rockford residents peacefully marched on May 30th. But the night ended with Rockford police unleashing tear gas on a crowd outside police headquarters after a few people threw rocks at the building. Stange shot video throughout the summer at demonstrations against police brutality held outside Rockford City Market. Demonstrations which erupted into violent confrontations where protesters were arrested.
There's a picture of the cop pointing literally a gun in my face. And then that's when it changed. Like, I knew, like, this is crazy.
This isn't Stange's first time picking up a camera to chronicle serious subjects. He's one of the teachers behind the award-winning student documentary series, The Harlem Veteran Project. But his We Demand videos aren't just to document the moment. The videos juxtapose images of Rockford protesters with civil rights leaders being beaten. They overlay footage of a Back the Blue rally with a speech from segregationist former Alabama Governor George Wallace. Stange wants his new project to help enact the change he believes Rockford needs, especially in policing.
I also felt that it was important to get another narrative out there, because I feel, especially in Rockford, a lot of times the one narrative is going to be the police narrative because they have the resources, access to stuff.
The city recently approved a contract for police body cams, but many activists are still highly skeptical of the promises of transparency.
They don't release the footage of the young man Tyrus Jones. They release footage of the other shooting that happened a few weeks ago of Jose Gonzalez, but they're not going to release the dash cam footage of a police chase that led to a car crash that killed people. Like, why are we picking and choosing here?
The Harlem high school teacher, who's white, says he wants to highlight other activists with his work, like the May 30th Alliance. Stange isn't affiliated with the group, but with its permission, uses videos from its Facebook page in his series. The We Demand series has also forced him to confront the ethical issues involved with recording violent police confrontations. Some have criticized the series for showing graphic footage of protesters punched and pepper sprayed without content warnings or blurring faces. Others say the images are too traumatizing for the people who experienced the violence and could allow law enforcement to use the videos as evidence for arrests. They ask if people even need more graphic examples of injustice.
I understand that it's stressful for them. I think what I need to do a better job of is maybe putting a warning.
Stange is going to continue to shoot video this summer at demonstrations. He says this time he's going to record more like a documentary, with a clear timeline of events and less focus on, quote, chaos if it unfolds. He says he hasn't promoted the videos in his classes, but he knows some former students who worked on the Harlem Veteran Project that have seen him. He doesn't think he's going to change the minds of those who don't believe racism is alive in Rockford, but even though they're tough to watch, he says he thinks it's good to get videos like his in front of people. People who know racial injustice and police brutalities are issues in America, but not necessarily in their hometown. I'm Peter Medlin.
All year long, Chicago school officials have been worried about students working remotely who've been chronically absent and falling behind. With the end of the school year now approaching, some school leaders are doing what they can to help them catch up. One charter high school is making a final pitch to bring back students who have fallen off track. Adriana Cardona-McGigad has more.
Miguel. Taking all day to come downstairs. What's wrong? Your ankle's still messed up.
On a recent April morning, Roe Clark High School principal Miracle Moss is visiting students who are struggling academically. She planned to visit 7 to 10 students that day. Roe Clark, a mostly black school near Humboldt Park, is one of 18 campuses managed by the Noble Network of Charter Schools. The school enrolls nearly 400 students.
Where's mom?
She's out. She just went to go get her eyelashes done. Yeah, I was like...
Tell her I came by.
Miguel is one of the students Moss visits. He's a junior. Moss acts more like an aunt. She jokes with him. She's approachable. They both agree he's got some catching up to do.
It's a lot. It's all I can say, a lot. I've been falling off. Falling off track. So I got to pick up all my stuff.
Student attendance has declined in many public schools. In Noble, one of the city's top charter schools, has also been hit. Several campuses experienced major declines, including Golder, DRW, and Bowles. All serve mostly black and Latino students. Roe Clark's latest attendance figure is around 67%, which Noble says may not fully capture all present students. That's down from 90% in 2019. Miguel is among a couple dozen teens flagged by school officials. He says the pandemic has been hard on him and his mom.
My OG, she's been back and forth with jobs because they won't fire her, but they'll have her on like notice. Like they'll tell her wait. They got a lot of people, so she's been working with my stepdad, and that's why I be working with him, trying to get a little bit of money. So that's how we making our money and stuff.
Moss invites Miguel to come to school for one-on-one support.
Because the teachers are going to be there, so like you'll get the direct support.
Most traditional Chicago public schools are not that flexible, with high schoolers expected to be learning remotely up to 7 hours a day. The main strategy to re-engage struggling kids has been to call them and email them. District officials pushed for in-person learning as the best way to reconnect with kids. Noble's approach is different. All students started the year learning remotely, but it offered a flexible schedule if needed. This is a newer tack for Noble, which historically has been quite strict. School buildings gradually began welcoming those who were struggling.
And so we reached out to those kids directly and said, hey, we're going to move into step two. What step two means is that, like, it's a targeted group of kids that's like may not be doing so well online.
Students like Miguel can get to school later, get tutoring, and a quiet place to work. She says her staff, including two social workers, keep checking in on them. The main goal for the April door knocking is to remind students that in-person instruction is about to start the following week. Moss asks Miguel if he had plans to be back in school.
I feel like that I'd be needing tutors. Like, I need somebody to help me with all stuff, because if I do it by myself, I know I'm going to forget about it. I'm just not going to do it. I'm trying to get help so I will stay on track.
Aside from helping with internet and technical problems, Moss drops off homework packets.
I've been on my phone, so it's been harder to get stuff.
Other students like Miguel don't look motivated to do schoolwork on their own.
What we're doing now is not school. What we was doing originally is actually school, like in the class.
Semaje is a sophomore. Moss and his grandmother say he was doing well in school, but all of a sudden he started falling behind in one class. Semaje says he's been distracted playing ball, and sometimes the internet doesn't work. He says he also feels unsafe. His grandmother, too, worries about Semaje's safety going to school.
It's hard out here for these young men. It really is. I mean, they struggle almost every day just to even go to the store. He's a good young man, very, very smart.
Moss offers to take him to school where he can get extra support. It's hard to tell at this point how well her efforts are paying off. Average third quarter GPAs are up slightly compared to last year when the pandemic first hit. Data from standardized tests is not available. Moss is hopeful her outreach will help, but still, it's not easy to find students.
Hi, does LeVar stay here?
No.
No, thank you. Do you know someone moved recently? It's one of my students from my high school.
The following week, in-person learning began at Roe Clark. On the first day, 101 students were back in the building.
If you've been scanned, you could just come through. Not you.
But that number went down. Moss says on average, more than 50 students have been showing up, including most of the students she visited the week before.
Questions about all of that?
Classes start at 12:30, but students with Fs who need help can start at 11. Those students can also get in-person tutoring after class.
Online questions. I know that review was kind of quick, just because we had some tech issues with getting everything ready.
About 85% of students are learning from home on any given day. Moss says they also try to give those students individualized support. She says the pandemic has pushed her to think creatively about how to connect with all her students moving forward.
The traditional, it may not be working for every student. And so the beauty is like being able to reimagine what that could look like for every kid and not just, you know, a subset of kids.
Ma says she and everyone at her school will keep trying to go after the students who fall behind. Her hope is to see a bustling school building filled with all her students once again. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
A reminder, if you miss any of our episodes of Statewide, you can find them and links to the stories in each program available at statewideshow.com. News this week that the former Illinois Lieutenant Governor Corinne Wood died following a long battle with breast cancer. She was the first woman to hold that position in Illinois, being elected with George Ryan in 1998. She later ran for governor, but she lost a bid for the Republican nomination in 2002. Wood was first diagnosed with breast cancer in the 1990s. She was an advocate for increased research funding. She would have turned 67 next week. In the wake of the George Floyd killing and the following protests, the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus drafted a series of reforms centered on creating more equity in criminal justice, education, economic development, and more recently, healthcare. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed those measures into law this spring, and with our Illinois Issues report, Maureen McKinney delved into the healthcare reform package.
Valina Atkinson confronted an overnight nurse who was sleeping while her daughter was under the nurse's care. Atkinson's daughter Helen suffered from lupus, an autoimmune disease. The nurse yelled at Atkinson, who was black. Atkinson later learned the nurse had made it known she had problems with people of color.
And my thing is, why would you even give her a patient of color knowing that she does not care for black people? But I just made sure she stayed away from, as much as I could, stayed away from Helen.
Atkinson's daughter, Helen Heath, died in March at age 35. Atkinson's perception that black patients are more likely to have inferior care as compared to their white counterparts is borne out by studies. To address the inequity in health care, a new Illinois law calls for implicit bias training for medical professionals. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the bill into law last month.
Health care is a right, not a privilege. But for too long, too many Illinoisans have been denied that right, whether through healthcare deserts, inexcusable delays in Medicaid applications, through lack of access, through high premiums, through doctors untrained to recognize symptoms on black skin.
While crafting the legislation, sponsors turned to experts in areas including medicine, sociology, African American studies, social work, and urban planning. Dr. Ruby Mendenhall, a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, has spent her career working at the cross-section of those areas and advised lawmakers while they put together their proposal. She told lawmakers about a study that showed many first and second year medical students believed that black skin was somehow thicker than white skin and blacks' nerve endings less susceptible to feeling pain than whites. Over a two-decade period, black patients were 22% less likely to receive pain medication. Meanwhile, black women are 6 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related issues, more than 70% of which were preventable.
When you do have health care and you go into the doctor's office or the hospital, what type of treatment you receive can literally have life and death consequences.
The Black Caucus's massive health care reform prompts a statewide anti-racism commission and halts the closure of safety net hospitals for the duration of the COVID-19 pandemic. The law also makes state investments to combat rates of infant and maternal morbidity, offers legal protections for those seeking treatment for opioid addiction, and caps costs for diabetes testing equipment. Longtime Senator Mattie Hunter, a Democrat from Chicago, has been working piecemeal for decades to stem discrimination against black patients.
It's just so interesting to find that African Americans have been hit hard with the highest rates of diabetes, kidney disease, cardiovascular diseases, asthma, and I can just go on and on and on and on.
Hunter says the legislation, which Republicans have said could cost as much as $12 billion, will save countless lives. Rockford Republican Dave Severson is spokesman of the state Senate committee that looks at health care. He says much of the multi-billion-dollar law is unaffordable for the cash-strapped state and is unlikely to pass the appropriation process.
The idea of we're having bad health outcomes currently, starting new programs without eliminating old programs or determining which programs are working and not working doesn't seem to make sense.
Hunter says reviews of that kind will occur. Meanwhile, Mendenhall, the U of I professor, is enthusiastic about parts of the legislation that would create workforce development for African Americans and train a corps of 100,000 community health workers who can act as liaisons between providers and minority people in need of medical treatment.
They already have some of the cultural wealth and the resources, and in many ways it's their gift and passion to do that. So I see as the two types of knowledge kind of coming together to create something that could really be a collective force for healing in the community.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
Still more to come here on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, an Illinois town tears down old dilapidated buildings with a plan for the future. That and more still to come. Dr. Ruby Mendenhall was a source for Maureen McKinney's Illinois Issues piece we just heard on Illinois' Black Caucus-inspired law to reform health care. Its goal is to make Illinois more equitable. Mendenhall served as an advisor to the Legislative Black Caucus, providing information about discrimination against people of color in the healthcare system. She's a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and here's more of the conversation with her.
My main question is, in what ways has racism played a role in healthcare and discriminatory treatment?
I talk a lot about when I do presentations is the documentary Unnatural Causes, Is Inequality Making Us Sick? Some of that is related to kind of the treatment that individuals receive. So it talked about 83,000 excess Black deaths based on research by former Surgeon General David Satcher. And then Rodriguez and his colleagues came along and looked at the number from 1970 to 2004 and saw like 2.7 million excess deaths, right? So more than what you would see from people dying from old age and more than what you would see from people getting sick.
Is this an area of research you've done, being that you were sought out by the legislature?
My undergraduate degree was in occupational therapy. And so I worked at Cook County Hospital, well then Cook County Hospital, and I was on the protective service team. And so many of the babies came in, fell into Thrive, so they weren't growing like they should for their age. And I remember we would often, in words or actions or other word or other deeds, ask like, what's wrong? Are you able to take care of the baby? Do we need to take the baby away? And I remember kind of over and over hearing a story where mothers would say, mostly mothers would say, you know, I don't have enough money to feed the baby. So what I'm doing is watering down their formula. And so I remember kind of after hearing it over and over and thinking, oh, okay, this is not an issue with the mothers if they're able to take care of their babies. This is an issue with society and that we won't provide them enough money to take care of their babies, right? And then this is what we see. And I talk about some of that in a paper that I wrote about the medicalization of poverty, how as a country we'll pay money, right, for the baby to be in the hospital sick and failing to thrive and not give enough money for parents who need that extra support. After I felt it was an issue with society, I went back to school, went to the University of Chicago and got a degree in public policy. And so after that, I went to the OUNCE Prevention Fund, their Kids Public Education and Policy Project. So work with legislators around child welfare, child care, welfare. And then I said, you know, I want to go to Robert Taylor because that's where we were going to do the program. And people were saying, well, why would you want to go to Robert Taylor? Who leaves downtown to go to Robert Taylor? And I was leaving because I was trying to still understand the mothers and not having enough money to feed their children. But also when I was in the policy world, I was often the only African-American and the only Black female. And so I remember thinking, well, why aren't those mothers that I talked to and the fathers at Cook County Hospital, why aren't they at the table trying to think about public policy and what they need to be well? And so I went to Robert Taylor. I worked there for 2 years and saw kind of the gun violence, poverty, many things. And even we would work with teenage girls. And we said, you know, you can create policy, right? You can come up with an idea. You can come up with what you need in terms of your community. And then, you know, the process is you have policymakers who sponsor it and other things. And the girls would say, some of them would say, okay, all right, but hurry up because I need to meet Mr. So-and-so so I can get some money to feed my children.
What are the pieces of House Bill 158 that you think may create the biggest change?
I would say So Article 772 that talks about understanding structural racism is important because another kind of big, bold, audacious vision is this idea of a third reconstruction, right? So we had the first one after slavery, the second one after Brown versus Board of Education in the civil rights era. And now this third one, what would it look like after, right, this experience with COVID, after the social unrest that continues? What would a new society look like? And I was at a conference where they were talking about structural racism, and they talked about this idea of a squishy ball. And, right, like you can apply pressure to a country, right? And when the pressure is applied, things may change, but once the pressure stops, it goes back to its natural shape. And it talked about the need to change the shape of the ball, to change the structure of the country. And so just kind of thinking about how do you usher in, how do you bring it? And many of the social forces are happening, right? There's large protests nationally, but also internationally. People who are in solidarity with the oppressed in the U.S., but also have their own oppression that they're protesting against. So I think that one, to really understand it, but also to understand its consequences, right? Those that are hidden before George Floyd, the level of oppression and the toll that it takes on groups in this country. So hopefully that bill will shed light, but then also, what do you do about it? What's the big shift that creates that change the structure of the ball, that changes the structure of this country? And so there is no need for a fourth or fifth reconstruction, right? Like, how do we get it right? And then also Article 115, where it talks about using technology and community-based resources. So you've heard me say over and over again about democratizing. What can we do on a large scale? How can we instill things so that the mother, uncle, brother, sister, cousin, Sunday school teacher, like everybody understands about COVID-19, how to protect against it. Everybody understands the importance of nutrition and sleep, right? And it talks about community-based resources to provide whole person care. So when someone comes in, and when I give talks, I show this iceberg, and I show the tip of it is when people come into the doctor's office often, and they have diabetes or other types of illnesses. But underneath that iceberg are all the things that's driving it, right? Like, do they have adequate housing? Do they have employment? Are they in neighborhoods that over centuries, decades, have not provided the resources that they need and their children need to thrive, right? Are the children coming in hospitals failing to thrive? And that's an obvious physical manifestation, but on all levels. So I love that it talks about provide whole person care from the mental, physical, spiritual, social, policy, right? All of those things need to operate together to foster health and wellness for not just individuals. I also do research that talks about community healing, right? Talks about collective trauma that is not just the individual, that there are systems in this country that affect entire groups. When kids show up in schools and they may be active or not listening, look at the whole person, think about what all is happening to them. So I'm hoping that's some of the stuff that happens.
That's Dr. Ruby Mendenhall, a professor at the University of Illinois. She also advised the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus on their efforts to pass a new equity-focused healthcare law in the state, and she spoke with Maureen McKinney. A legislative task force is reviewing whether to remove and replace certain statues and monuments currently located on the Illinois State Capitol grounds in Springfield. Adam Green is an associate professor of history at the University of Chicago. He says it's important to evaluate what values monuments represent and whether they still hold up in modern society.
We know that no individual is flawless and that all historical figures are, to some extent, prisoners of their pasts. What values of ours are likely to be judged narrow, ineffective, naive, and which ones might prove truly serviceable to the future?
Other suggestions offered at a hearing this week included removing statue pedestals, commissioning abstract statues, and moving all sculptures off of the Illinois Capitol grounds to a new location. The task force plans to continue holding public meetings at least through the summer. Well, General Motors and General Electric, just two of the major employers that have left the Danville area over the last 50 years. And as the East Central Illinois town lost manufacturing, it also lost people, about 12,000 people compared to its peak population of more than 42,000 in 1970. The loss has left Danville with many empty and decaying buildings. Jim Meadows reports on how the city is tearing down those buildings with the hope it can one day grow again.
The house on South Buchanan Street had been a familiar sight in Danville's Rabbit Town neighborhood for decades. But a city employee operating a Caterpillar excavator knocked it down in a matter of minutes. Timothy Dixon came out to watch the final moments of a house where he had spent a lot of time growing up.
Just to see it go, I'm not no emotional person, you know, but it's it'd be nice if we could have still had it here.
The house once belonged to Dixon's grandparents. He remembers visiting his grandmother there often until her passing and living there for a time himself. Dixon says his sister owned the house in 2017 when an electrical fire reduced it to a shell.
It's just something that's been in the family for decades, half a century, as a matter of fact.
The city of Danville acquired this house in a delinquent tax sale, just as it acquired most of the more than 350 buildings it's torn down since 2016. All of the buildings were considered too damaged to save. And for Mayor Ricky Williams Jr., their demolition has been a necessary step towards Danville's future growth.
We have a great excess of housing in our community, a lot of which has become abandoned and dilapidated.
Williams says getting rid of blighted buildings frees land up for redevelopment and eliminates buildings that could collapse or attract crime. One example dates back to 2015 when Scott Eisenhower was mayor of Danville and Williams served on the city council. He says squatters were congregating at vacant commercial buildings on West Main Street downtown, next door to the David Palmer Arena.
So people were getting propositioned and solicited as they came out of meetings. Several years ago, we worked with Mayor Eisenhower to purchase all those properties and get them demolished. And now we have a beautiful green space that welcomes people to town instead of what looks like blighted drug properties.
Danville's demolition program is not unique, not even for Central Illinois, where Decatur and Peoria also have building demolition programs. But could any of the buildings Danville has torn down in the last 5 years have been saved? That question is raised by newly elected Alderwoman Tricia Teague. She agrees that once they're beyond reasonable repair, the buildings have to go.
But I also believe that some houses have gone into disrepair because of the poverty in the community and because people have not maybe been aware of the assistance that might be available to them.
Teague says future blight could be prevented if more Danville homeowners knew about home repair and weatherization programs offered by the city and by the local Community Action Agency, where she's a board member. Meanwhile, the city of Danville's demolition program continues, with 46 buildings on the teardown list for this year. And Timothy Dixon, while mourning the loss of his late grandmother's house, says he hopes the city will get around to tearing down an empty house next to his own.
Because the property value will go up and it just don't look good next to my house or anybody else's neighborhood house. So I think they're doing a good job trying to clean up Danville a little bit, trying not to make it look so ghost townish.
Tearing down buildings costs money. Danville spends an average of $12,500 to demolish a house and take environmental safeguards while doing so. But Mayor Williams says he thinks Danville could see new growth in just a few years, thanks in part to the demolition program. For now, he says there are still hundreds of blighted buildings in the city that need to go. I'm Jim Meadows.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Join us next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, find them all at our website, statewideshow.com. You can also listen to our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.